Welcome to Story of a Storyteller. I'm your host, Connor Braden. This is the show where I found out all about the ins and outs of the lives of storytellers of all kinds. You can find my free novella, The Stolen Dagger, episode show notes, links to all sorts of amazing books, and more at connorbraden.com/podcast. Enjoy!
Just write down what you want to see. I think that's my biggest advice.
But I'm more focused on uniting people.
She said to me, I never would have dreamed. You are a writer.
If the normal works for you, great. If it doesn't, don't beat yourself up over it.
I think anybody can get the words on the page, but a real writer will know how to fix it.
I always kind of feel poverty and hunger nipping at my heels.
Realizing that I wasn't mad.
The one mistake people make when they're submitting things is submitting them too early.
And then my brain just went, you're going to write a book.
You put your heart and soul into a book.
Well, 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 if it isn't yourself. This is episode 6 of Story of a Storyteller podcast. I have a great interview for you today. I got to interview Qian Julie Wang, a woman with an amazing and absolutely inspiring life story. Julie wrote a memoir of her childhood, which was picked up by Doubleday and Viking Publishing. It's due to come out in autumn next year. I got to talk to her about living in New York and living in poverty in New York, as well as the difference it was to leave China when her and her family were fairly well off. We talk about her parents' decision and motives behind moving to the US, as well as the troubles she had while in the education system over there. Julie also shared how she wrote her entire memoir on her phone. Since the interview, Julie and I were talking, and it turns out that Doubleday Books have chosen her memoir as their lead book for autumn 2021. A huge deal, in my opinion, as it shows just how much Doubleday believes in her book. And congratulations once again to Julie. I really cannot wait to read it. Now for the writing report. I'm really, really getting back into the stride, thankfully. I was at 77,674 words last time, and I set myself a goal of getting to 79,000 at least. Well, I managed to get even further than my goal again, thankfully, and I'm now at 80,877 words. So another roughly 3,000 words in the week, and I'm absolutely delighted with that. I initially planned that the book would be 95,000 words, so I'm getting close to the end. And in terms of the plot, I feel like the book might be longer than 95,000 words, but I am getting towards the end. I think it might actually end up being maybe 105 as opposed to 95,000, but we'll see. So I am getting very close to the end. The final goal will be finishing the book before Halloween, which at the rate I'm going, I'm fairly confident I can do. But of course, things can always go awry in the life of a writer. Before we go on to the interview, I'd also like to give a shout out to new patron Michael Andrews, who is an aspiring writer himself. So he'll actually be using the critiquing service I have via Patreon. So do check out the Patreon page for the other perks that you yourself can avail of, and you'll find the link in the show notes below. Anyway, you're not here to hear me waffle on, you're here to hear Julie's interview. Hello and welcome to episode 7 of Story of a Storyteller podcast. My guest today is Qian Julie Wang, and the author of Beautiful Country, Memoirs of an Undocumented Childhood. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be part of the show.
No bother. I'm so excited to have you. And I have to compliment your very nice metropolitan background there of the shelf and the window and the nice greenery.
I've been having a lot of video conference meetings and hearings and all of that, so quickly realized that a random background was not going to work, so I had to set this up.
I've had to really find the best angle of my bedroom I can, because I live in a two-room apartment.
Same, actually. This is my dining table, and now it is my desk, so we just eat at the kitchen counter.
Very good. So we're going to get stuck in. I know you were born in, now
I'm going to try this. I got it right earlier, and I hope I get it right now. Xuzhuang.
Great. Yay. You got it right.
in China. And you moved to the US when you were 7. So what can you remember of your time in China?
Yeah, this is actually a big part of the opening of my book. It technically opens when we're on the plane, but there are some flashbacks. So my mom and I are on the plane when I'm 7, but there's some flashbacks to the days leading up to us leaving China. My dad left China when I was 5. And as a kid, it was really drastic to have your dad there every day. And then he just gets on some metal box and then you never see him for at least 2 years. And you just hear him through the phone lines every now and then. Yeah. And in China back then, so this was 94, there was a lot of misinformation about what America was like. There were a lot of videos that I think may still be out there of homeless people on streets after streets fighting over food. You know, a video of like a pigeon being, and then ostensibly people going after the pigeon to try to eat it. Like, we thought it was incredibly awful, incredibly difficult to survive in the US. And then there was the other end. I remember having this conversation with my uncles, and one uncle was like, oh yeah, I heard America's amazing. Those streets are paved with gold. Everyone has so much to eat. There's free food everywhere. And then my other uncle being like, no, have you seen these videos? They're starving. They can't even afford clothes. And so as a kid, I really was terrified of leaving because China was all I knew. The fact that I was going to be going to a country where there were people of different races did not even register in my mind at all. Cause I just, as a kid, when you're in a homogenous society, you don't really have a context for that. So going to the airport was the first time I saw someone with blue eyes and I was really freaked out. Like, I had never seen that before. And you know, a lot of white people in it. And it's true that when you're not used to people seeing people of different races, they all kind of look similar to you until you learn to discern the difference. So my mom took me on that plane kicking and screaming. I didn't want to leave. I just got a new bike. And I had no idea what to expect because it was like either horrible or there was gold everywhere. And I didn't really care about that anyway, because I just wanted to be with my friends and family.
Yeah, of course. And that's two such drastic extremes as well. So for such a young child to have to figure out maybe there's a middle ground on her own, like, it must have been very scary, really.
Yeah. And I didn't even process it as, like, I don't even, when you're a kid, you just kind of accept what's coming and you're just like, oh, this sucks. Like, I don't know what to expect. Mm. But there was the other element of, I'd always been around my extended family, my grandparents, my uncles, my aunts. And it didn't even register to me that once we got on that plane, like my father, right, he didn't see the rest of us again. And that would be the case for us. When you're a kid, you have no way of understanding that until it's actually happening. And then you're realizing, oh, I put my new bike in a storage bin and I'm probably not going to get back to that bike anytime soon. It's probably going to rust. So it was a lot. It was a lot that I think I'm grateful that I had the child's presence in mind to process it, because as an adult, I'm sure it must have been so much harder for my parents.
Of course. Yeah. And that's actually something I wanted to ask you. You said about how there was such a huge, like, even for your two, I'm assuming, adult uncles, to be saying, oh, the streets are paved with gold, and the other one saying, hey, you're crazy, look at this video of a man eating a pigeon. You know, like, what was it, do you know, that, how did your father come, and mother, I'm assuming as well, come to that decision to move to a country where they're getting such mixed messages from?
Yeah, it was a truly brave decision. I actually come from a family of dissident writers in China, my father's side. So his oldest brother was 18 when my father was about 6. And this was kind of when the Cultural Revolution was happening. And my uncle, my father's oldest brother, wrote an essay criticizing Chairman Mao and everything that was happening, all the upheaval and how he was just using the idealistic Red Guards for his own political purposes, and Chairman Mao didn't actually care about all of us. much of this was true. It was very, you know, there was a lot of insight in that piece, but he distributed it publicly. He wrote his name to it, and so he got thrown into prison, and he was tortured and starved, and that kind of, that was the background against which my father grew up. So his earliest memory is from 4 years old, and he remembers seeing, and this is in the very prologue of my book, he remembers seeing two men hanging from a tree in the courtyard in his village because they were persecuted for something they didn't do, and they had written in blood that they were, in the Chinese character for innocent or wrongly accused. So my father grew up in extreme upheaval. He grew up hating the government for what they did to his brother, and then his entire family was blackballed. So he had a lot of trouble. No matter how hard he studied or how well he did in school, he just could not get a good grade. And the teachers regularly have him stand up in front of the class, and the students and the teachers would berate him and say how he was from a family of treasonists and all of that. So my father eventually left that village and became an English literature professor, and he fell in love with Dickens and the idea that you can write things that challenge the government and the freedom of thought. And of course, to his mind, the U.S. represented that, and there was no other place he wanted to go. And as he was, you know, teaching in classes, he realized that the government was not entirely liking what he was necessarily saying, and he couldn't teach, he couldn't talk about the Cultural Revolution, he couldn't freely talk about his thoughts, and so he decided to come here, and then just could not see himself going back. He just couldn't see subjecting himself to that government again that he never believed in, and so my mom made the very difficult decision of, you know, do I raise my daughter here without her father, or pursue him in this other land that we know nothing about? And she decided to follow him. So,
a brave woman to do so as well, because, like, did she have as extreme a negative relationship with the government as your father and his family did, or was this something she kind of learned more about that through her husband?
Yeah, so she was more sheltered from it. My maternal grandfather was actually pretty high up in the government, so it's pretty interesting that she came from the other side. Yeah, but during the Cultural Revolution, Chairman Mao sent all intellectuals out to the countryside and far away from Beijing to be re-educated. And so her family went through that as well. But certainly she did not see the extent of abuse and oppression that my father did, and she also didn't speak any English. She was, my father was an English literature professor, my mom was a math professor. She didn't know the first word of English. I think she knew apple, and that was it. So it was both kind of just a representation of her faith and her love for my father and her dedication to keeping our family together, and a real act the courage, the first of many, I would say, after we immigrated.
Yeah, and I suppose it also speaks to the trust she had in your dad at that time, because to bring up what you said about your two uncles, like, and I'm assuming based on context, they were your mother's brothers, were they?
Yes, my mother's brothers, yep.
So like to even hear her brothers arguing two sides of the coin and her husband is gone, like it's... It sounds like both your parents had to make really brave and difficult decisions.
Yeah, and what my dad was reporting of the U.S. was much closer to that of starvation and hunger than obviously the streets of gold, right?
Yeah.
So she kind of had some sense. She had more sense certainly than I did of what the conditions would be like over here. And she grew up fairly well off in China. So that was another big adjustment, I would say, for all of us.
So I was kind of looking and researching about you because it's such an interesting story, and your book isn't published yet, but I'm like, as soon as there is a pre-order option, I'm clicking it because it's,
I appreciate it. Thank you.
It sounds like such an amazing story. But one thing I found when I was researching for the interview is you wrote something in the New York Times, and I'm just going to read out the quote for the people listening and watching. You said, "On my first day of school in America, I paused outside the red brick school on Chinatown's Division Street in Manhattan, turned to my father and asked him how could we trust that the school wouldn't have us deported. So I'm bringing this up specifically because my background, I'm a teacher, and if like I teach the age you were at that time, and it just horrifies me that a child could come to school with that huge amount of weight and pressure on them and the anxiety of never knowing when the shoe's going to drop or when the knock's going to come on the door. So what was your experience in school after that first moment? What was it like?
So in that piece, I actually say my dad assured me that the U.S. is a country that's governed by the rule of law. They have a Supreme Court case that said that all children are entitled to education, including undocumented children. And my dad's assurance of that really made me feel a lot better. I mean, as a kid, right, your parents tell you what's going on and you believe in that intrinsically. Yeah. What I didn't know was that he didn't really know. He wasn't sure. He was like, I guess I'm just going to tell her this because she needs an education. And actually, he was called in a few times because we had given, so we lived in Brooklyn, in a pretty poor area of Brooklyn. There were no Chinese immigrants, and my parents really wanted me to go to the Chinatown school because there would be at least some teachers who spoke English, and there would be some students, many students who were Chinese, and my mom actually worked at the sweatshop garment factory across the street, so it was convenient for many reasons, but we gave a fake address to be able to go to that school. And of course they caught us because it was apparently a warehouse. And my dad got called in, and I was not privy to any of this. My dad got called in and he was sure that we were going to be deported. And they were just like, we know that you don't live here. It's fine. We're going to look the other way, but don't lie to us. Give us your actual address and we'll just make sure you get your mail. But I think there were several instances like that. Another instance, a few weeks after I started, so I didn't speak any English. Most of the kids at school were born there. They were Chinese or, you know, children of Chinese immigrants, but their English was fairly good. And so at one point the teacher actually had me designated as ESL. Oh. But surprisingly in that Chinatown school, there weren't many ESL students.
And so just for the people listening, ESL stands for English as a Second Language. In Ireland, we call it EAL, which is English as an Additional Language. But it's the same thing. But continue.
Yeah. So they put me in a special needs classroom. Wow. And there were, I don't remember how many kids, probably six to eight kids, I would imagine. And the room was kind of set up. It wasn't set up like a classroom. It was set up like a playroom. There were building blocks and picture books. And nobody, there was one teacher for all of us. She was way too busy with the kids who needed a little bit more attention than me. I was happy to just sit there and read. So I got no attention. I was pretty much not talked to most school days. And I just started reading all the books. I read Clifford the Big Red Dog, The Berenstain Bears Go to School, The Very Hungry Caterpillar, Amelia Bedelia, like all of the kind of, I think back on these books and like a tear comes to my eyes because it was how I learned English. And I was in that class for maybe a month or so. And I told my dad, I think I'm ready to go back. I'm not really learning. Like if I don't do well at first, that's fine. But at least there's like a teacher in the front of the room talking to me. And he very bravely again went back into the administration office and asked for that to happen, and thankfully I was placed back with the normal I guess mainstream. Whatever you call it, mainstream kids, and struggled for a bit, but pretty much by December, so I started school in September, second grade, by December I was almost as fluent. I mean, kids just learn. I don't know how I learned so quickly, but I learned very quickly. And I was able to kind of get up to speed. But the other element of public school that was really a saving grace was that we didn't have much money at all, and we didn't have enough to eat. And I saw my mother kind of counting the coins, and she was making 1 cent per article of clothing at the sweatshop she worked. I would go across the street and join her. My job was to like snip at the threads, the loose threads. So I knew that we were struggling. I never struggled before. I was fairly well off in China. My grandpa was so high up, we got free food all the time everywhere we went. but I could tell that, you know, we didn't have enough. So thankfully the public school had free lunch for me and free breakfast. So I told my mom, you don't need to worry about feeding me for at least two meals of the day. And I could come here and I'll just rely on the public school for food. Unfortunately, the breakfast, I rarely got there in time because they started really early and I lived all the way in Brooklyn and my parents didn't quite know. So I remember being so incredibly hungry in the mornings, waiting, just staring at the clock and waiting for lunch, for that lunch bell, and then waiting in the long, cafeteria, you line up against the walls and it felt like hours. I'm sure it wasn't, but it felt like hours to get your free food. And then of course the richer kids would sit in the middle with their home packed meals. And the level of envy I felt, I can't even tell you. It's just an interesting dynamic, right? Social dynamic that you're put in as a kid before you really even understand that people have more than you. Like, you just accept that what you have is what everyone has and there's no big difference. But that was when I really started to realize, oh no, there are different ranks and there are different social economic classes and I'm clearly at the very bottom. And it was a difficult thing to grapple with as a hungry kid.
I can't imagine. I mean, I remember my very first teaching job, I was working in the inner city of Dublin in an area with social and economic disadvantaged children. And in Ireland, we call them DESH schools. DESH is an Irish word that means hope, but DEIS also stands for I can't remember what it stands for right now, so I'm a great teacher, but children in DESH schools get free lunches, but children in other schools don't. And I remember one girl, it's just because you brought this back, and it's just, I'm showing the other side of the coin, I suppose. She brought her lunch, but she never ate the full lunch, whereas all the other children would. And they came in these little paper bags with their names written on them. And one day, I just had noticed this, and I took a note, and I went to her, and I won't say her name, obviously, but I'll say she was Julie. And I went to her and said, Julie, why aren't you eating all your lunch? Are you not a bit hungry? And she just said, well, if I eat it all now, I won't have something to eat later when I go home. So it sickens me that what happened to you in the 90s can still happen now. And I'm sure it's happening in America, like in some schools. It can't not, because of the system that we have, unfortunately.
And especially now, I think part of the reason and the difficulty why the New York school systems held out on closing during the pandemic for so long was because they know that a lot of kids rely on the school to get meals and to get heating or air conditioning or internet or whatever it may be. And schools have become the source of public support and public services that really the government on its own, separate from the school, should take more responsibility for.
Yeah, I mean, for a lot of parents, especially immigrants, it is sometimes the only point of contact you have to somebody who might be able to help you or find out forms to fill in or supports you can avail of and all that kind of a thing. So it's, I suppose you're right, schools can be very, very important, and for them to close. We had a similar thing in Ireland where the very few schools that do provide food, that was the first thing that happened. There was this huge uproar of, well, what about those children? How do we get that food to them? Thankfully, we did manage to sort out a kind of a delivery service, and each school had to figure out how to deliver it. But yeah, it must have been very, I just can't imagine. And like, how did you feel then as a young child? When you realized that there was haves and have nots, and you were like, oh, I'm a have not, did you then realize how lucky you were in China? Or did you just think that everyone was similar to you in China and that you were just in the America that everyone was on the street hungry?
Yeah, I didn't even think, that's a good question. I didn't even think back to China. I mean, I missed, obviously, I have a diary. I wrote in the diary and journal every day. And so I can actually see what I wrote as a kid. And I wrote a lot about the dumplings my grandma would make me and how, like, once my uncle and I had a competition to see who could eat the most dumplings. And now that would be so wasteful to just eat if you're not hungry.
Yeah.
But other than that, I didn't really think about China being like, oh, I was a have and there were people who were have nots. Like, I didn't, it wasn't even in my childhood frame of reference. But it did make me, I mean, looking at those journal and diary entries again, which was very helpful in writing my book, I think it bred a sense of competition in me, which, you know, is probably a endemic problem of capitalism. Like, it's you versus me, it's a zero-sum game. This girl has a home-packed meal and I don't, and so I hate her, rather than when you're growing up in that scenario, right, it's you versus her rather than, you know, society or the government that should be providing more. But now that I see beyond that, I'm still able to understand that hunger, which I have spent a lot of time in therapy processing and still have a lot to go, because I think physical trauma is just very different. That hunger has driven me to achieve a lot, because I always, no matter how far I get from that cafeteria where I'm starving, I always kind of feel poverty and hunger nipping at my heels. A little bit, and that's could be a good thing, could be a really energizing thing, but it can also be a very big drain on you when you no longer are in that situation. I'm very lucky not to be anymore, but it also drives me to give back and not be disconnected from that world and children who are there are many children out there who are still hungry in schools today, and that it just reminds me of that.
And just to kind of speed forward from young childhood to college, you're a Yale graduate, which it's such a huge gap. I mean, to put it in context, even like the vast majority of English speaking countries know of Yale and Harvard. Do you know what I mean? Like, yeah. It's they're not even just big in America. Like, Irish kids playing in the playground would mention it because they heard it on TV or a film or something, you know. So what was that like to go from the girl who is ignored in a special needs class reading Clifford the Dog to Yale? Like, that must have been, like, obviously you're an intelligent person, but that must have been a lot of hard work on your part.
Yeah, I, you know, that competition I mentioned earlier, I figured if there was absolutely, my view in college, so I like went to two parties in college, and otherwise just, I worked 40 hours a week at jobs and I studied. That was what I did. And I thought if there was anything I could do possibly in my life to get as ahead as possible, I'm going to do it. I'm going to maximize every single opportunity I have. I don't care if I sleep 4 hours a night. I can sleep later when I feel safer, right? Like, I don't have to be worried about being hungry. And that drive really pushed me. And I was, you know, I was like, and there were several times, so I went to Swarthmore College, which is a liberal arts college in Pennsylvania, and I told my counselor, or the professor who was assigned to mentor me, my first day of college, I said, I'm going to Yale Law School or I'm going to Harvard Law School. Those are my two options. And it wasn't even my parents. I was just like, you know, lawyers make money. Those are the best law schools. Those are my options. Prefer to go to Yale, but and the professor, who was a white man, laughed at me. He looked at my records and my high school records, and he was like, you went to this shitty high school that nobody's heard of. You're the first person from the school on our campus. You're lucky to be here. Harvard and Yale are for superstars, and you're not a superstar. And there have been so many moments like that. And your students are very lucky to have you as a good teacher. And I have had amazing teachers who have been supportive and loving and believed in me, who have been enough to counter people like that in my life. But there have been many moments in my education where I've encountered, unfortunately, and I think many people have, professors or teachers who just don't really believe in their students. I've had three professors who accused me of plagiarism because there's no way I could write that well. From that session with that professor, he said, Yale's for superstars, and I can't get in. Well, I'm going to show you, right? Like, now I have an audience to prove wrong. And not only is this now for me, it's also for these other people who don't believe in me for some reason. So it wasn't the healthiest and probably wasn't the most mature way to go about it, but I worked endlessly. I, you know, sacrificed probably many friendships that I could have made and strengthened. And when I got to Yale, it was, I thought the fight was over. I was there. I earned my place. I'm good. And then I realized, oh shoot, all these people grew up rich and went to really fancy private high schools and ride horses, and I just don't fit in at all. I remember the first day, these girls were talking about, like, do you go riding? Where do you go riding? And I was like, I don't know how to ride a bike. And they're like, no, we mean horses. And I was like, oh, like, that was not even in my frame of reference. So I, long story short, I developed a huge chip on my shoulder that I'm still working on now. But there are also, I met so many amazing people along the way, people who actually, there were other people who had grown up undocumented at Yale that I met. And there are people who grew up very wealthy and privileged at Yale who have become my best friends. And I, over time, very slowly learned to see beyond that barrier. And I think it was only when I accepted myself for where I came from that I could accept others and just take a friendship or connection as what it is. Because as you remind yourself that you were a poor kid from the wrong side of Brooklyn and you were hungry, you're just never going to have the space to allow for that friendship or to allow for those people. And that was when I really had to learn to slow down and kind of understand myself better and understand other people better and build those connections that have just made my life so much better.
It's such a crazy story, because it's just, I can't get over teachers and professors being like that. Like, when you first said what that professor said to you, like, yeah, it's for superstars, you're not a superstar. There was a the eternal optimist, I say, but my boyfriend always says it's, I'm being naive. I straight away thought, maybe he said that to light the fire in her.
Maybe, but it worked. No. If he did, yeah, it worked.
I suppose.
So, yeah, I mean, and I've had friends who, like, did you ever go back to him and tell him that you got in? I was like, oh yeah, I didn't even bother. It was like, not worth the time. Maybe if I'd gone back, I'd figured out that maybe he meant well by it. I don't know.
Yeah, well, whether he meant well or not, it served you well. And let's just focus on that instead. So then, now you went to Yale, you made friends with people who had a lot of privilege growing up, people who were more similar to you, and you graduated, and now you're a commercial litigator, isn't
it?
Yeah. So when on that kind of journey did you decide to start writing your book?
So I have always wanted to write this book. I loved, as I mentioned, reading. Reading really got me through a very difficult childhood. My favorites were The Babysitter's Club, which has now recently been released on Netflix. I made my husband watch it with me twice over. It's amazing. And Babysitter's Club is just about, like, normal kids dealing with normal problems. And I just thought it was so cool that I had access to, like, oh, this is what it's like in, like, a little town in America where you know, parents who work in office buildings and you don't need to worry about citizenship and all of that. And it kind of just opened my eyes to things, parts of the world and the country I didn't know. But anyway, so I always wanted to write my story because I couldn't find it in the library. I wanted to know that someone had gone through this and made it out okay, because that, I mean, growing up with that level of insecurity, you just want to make sure. I mean, money was a big thing for us, right? Like, but it was also, you just want to make sure your parents get out okay, and we won't be deported and sent back to China where the government will come after us, all of those things. And I just couldn't find that model anywhere. So I started my first attempt at this actually in college, senior year. My fourth year, I took a creative writing class, and it was awful. It was just an awful, like, when you asked for an older piece of writing, that was the first piece I thought of. And then I thought I hated that thing so much, I must have deleted it by now. I wrote it as fiction, which is, I think, the number one problem for my story, is because it's so hard for anyone to come forward and say they were undocumented. But that is exactly what you need to empower other immigrants and other people in that situation, that you know, I'm out here speaking for myself and also in a way speaking for all of us. Everyone's experience is different. Everyone's experience being undocumented is very different. And this is mine, but in that way I can create a platform for everyone. And by fictionalizing it, I was really kind of just burying or digging into the shame of having been undocumented. And that was the problem. I was just too young to write it well. I didn't have the perspective. I hadn't thought about all the ways that it affected me. It was just not the time for that story to be written. So I put it aside. I didn't think about it. And I was like, I'm just not gonna, it didn't work. I'm gonna go forward and do this law thing and see where I go. And so I went to law school. I clerked for two judges. I worked in two different firms and in government. And it was really in 2016. So in 2016, in May, I became a citizen. So over 22 years after I first stepped foot here. And the amount, the feelings that welled up in me in that ceremony, I didn't want anyone there. So I became naturalized before my parents did. And they said, can we come? And I said, no, I don't. I want to be able to just sit there and just kind of feel everything. And it was both anger and sadness and joy and peace. And just, it was just the most emotional 1 hour of my life. And then, of course, in November, Donald Trump won the election. It was the first election I finally got to vote in. I was like, yes, Hillary's going to win. I get to cast a vote for my first female president. And then Donald Trump won. And I was so angry again. And I'm like, I feel like I traveled so far and now we're back. It feels like in some ways we're back because the whole rhetoric is all anti-China rhetoric, which is still going on. Anti-immigrant rhetoric, just so much hate that he was spewing. And I realized I'm a citizen now. I'm much more mature. I've been in therapy. This is more personal, but I was married. I got married after law school and I got divorced before. We'd separated before the election, in part because he voted for Trump. And it was an awakening for me, right? That like, where is my life right now? I'm working for corporations. I represent these celebrities and rich people, and I'm not really doing anything to give back to where I came from. So in early 2017, I started working on this book. And so, you know, I completed my first full manuscript end of 2019, but I also met my second husband, my now husband, during that time, and we got married and went on a honeymoon. So there were pauses in between, but I felt even throughout that whole time, just a real sense of urgency that I had a duty to share my story and to tell it and to use my platform and my privilege, my newfound privilege, for the people who are now in even worse conditions than I was in growing up.
Yeah, because that's something I wanted to ask you that, to be honest, I hadn't considered it while researching. Like you lived the life of a child, undocumented child. And coincidentally, I didn't mention this to you, but I was born in New York, but my parents were undocumented. Oh, wow. But because I was born there, I had citizenship. Now we moved back to Ireland when I was four and I was just about to start school. So it's very interesting hearing this story because a tiny part of me is going, wow, is this the path not taken for my family? Like what could have happened, you know? But how do you feel now looking at ICE and the wall and all that kind of stuff? Like, do you think that fuels the book as well and wanting to get your story out there and make people look at undocumented people in their country a lot more compassionately? Or is that just a coincidence that all this stuff is happening while you're writing your book?
It's a little bit of both. Things have definitely worsened as I've been working on my book, and that has fueled me. It's given me even more a sense of urgency. My hope with this book, so I wrote it in a non-political way. It's told from my childhood voice, and the voice grows up. So in the beginning, there's some Chinese spread out, transliterated Chinese, and then it becomes fully fluent. And my hope is that it will touch people's hearts more than their minds, because that's how you change people's minds. Like if you just start talking about politics, people who believe in Trump and support them, they're stuck there. and that's not how you reach them. But if you tell it from a perspective of a child who has no idea what's going on and who is just taking things as they come to her and grappling with it, it may have people thinking, well, do I want to support a government who perpetuates this? Do I want to be part of the country that creates this sense of oppression and hunger and deprivation for this lower class of people that we've just created? More so though, as I mentioned earlier, I want to write it for the immigrants. And I've had a bunch of early readers, including immigrants who weren't undocumented, and they felt that their experience overlapped with mine. And it was good to have the story to really humanize the immigrants that you're talking about when you're saying, like, oh, these people don't have papers and they're working as busboys. Like, what does that actually look like? And the stories are not just of me and my parents, but of people who are around us working in the sweatshops next to us, and the heartbreak that they went through, not being able to see their children in China or Korea or wherever it may be for many years, and just communicating with them on the phone or by letter. So I think, in as much as I want to sway people politically, I just want them to see that we are all not that different. We're all human, and the emotions that I felt and the anger and jealousy that I felt, I'm sure in some way anyone could relate to growing up and seeing kids who maybe had it a little bit better than them.
I suppose you could maybe say your intention is to sway people's hearts and right. hope that the politics right. will follow. Just more to kind of step away from the emotional side, let's more talk about the actual mm-hmm. the writing side. So your book has been picked up by Doubleday Publishing for North America and Viking in the UK, the Commonwealth, and Ireland. Before we really, really delve yeah. into your daily writing structure and all that, like, how did you get, what was it like to get published, and what was that journey?
I still can't believe it. I wake up every day and I'm like, I can't, I must have dreamed it. And then I have to, well, the day after I got the deal, I actually woke up at 5 a.m. and I was like, I made this up. I dreamed it. And I had to open my Gmail and be like, oh no, there's an email saying that this happened. So I must not be imagining it. I feel incredibly lucky that I would have been happy with my book going out as an ebook, right? Like, just self-publishing. I just wanted my story out there. And the fact that some of the biggest publishers out there believe in me, and such amazing editors believe in me, it's just, it feels like a real, real dream come true. I feel like with any book, it's a lot of luck, right? Your writing style may not be to everyone's taste. No one's writing style is. And just to have found people who see what is behind my project and really believe that it can happen, means the world, really does mean the world to me. And I just got extraordinarily lucky. So I don't know if you want me to delve into the writing part. It's kind of tied into how I got plugged in.
I suppose more specifically what I mean is, like, had you queried the book for long? Did you have an agent who kind of went to publishers, or did you go direct to publishers? Like, more of that,
yeah.
What was that?
So I took I had an agent, and I met my agent through a writing class that I took in Catapult, which is a New York writing class. The teacher of that class was amazing, and she believed, so by the time I was in her class, I had like 3 chapters. I really didn't have a whole lot, but she believed in it from the beginning, and she is one of the top editors at Huffington Post. So she said that whatever I needed, she was happy to do for me. And I was very grateful. And this was in 2017, very early on. So I was like, oh, okay, I don't know what I need because I have 3 chapters. So, and she said, this is the best advice I can give you. Finish writing the whole thing before you talk to anybody. Because this is your first book. You're still not quite sure what you want it to look like. You're not an established voice. You need to be happy with it before you send it to someone in publishing who may have very different ideas of what your book should look like. And I thought that was a little contrary to what I heard, because I knew a lot of people who had gotten book deals from proposals, but I trusted her. She seemed to really care about me and my book. So I took that route. I finished the entire thing, and then I got in touch with her and I said, I'm done. What do I do now? And she put me in touch with my amazing agent, Andriana Yates at ICM Partners, who just loved, she also just understood what my book was about. And she is also she's younger in agent and still kind of growing her roster, and really made me feel understood and cared for. And we just got along really well, like friends. And it's really nice to go through that process with someone. And she gave me edits. So the draft she saw of my book was the second draft, pretty much, ever. I wrote the full draft and then I proofread it. And then I gave it to her because I didn't know what to do. And she gave me notes and we did two rounds of edits. And then she said, okay, it's time to start submitting. And I was like, are you sure? I need to make it absolutely perfect. She's like, that's not going to happen. We need to start submitting. And that process went actually very quickly. We submitted to many editors. I want to say around 20, maybe a little less. And heard back. I got my offer, which was a preempt, within days. It's about 5 days. Yeah. So she had already kind of called people and told and raved to them. And she had her colleagues at ICM rave to editors. So she kind of did the front leg work of that. And it's really shown me what it means to have an agent who really cares about your project and can really advocate for you. Because I didn't even know what editors to submit to. I didn't know anything. Like I told her, I trust you. You do what you want with it. I really don't understand what's going on. Just let me know when I need to make a decision. And I just could not be happier. And then I got on the phone with the editors before they made the offer. And it just, from the first instant, they understood my vision. And that was the most important thing for me. As I said to my agent and my editor, this book is my first baby. I want to put all I have into it. And I trust I could have asked for no better guardians than the people that I have now. So.
That's brilliant. I think you're really reminding me of a phrase I heard where about editors and how, like, I can't remember. I think it was a conversation I was following on Twitter or something like that. But there was two people talking, and one was saying they're worried about editors because they will change the book and make it into a completely different thing. And the other person argued, well, what a good editor does is they take your book and make it your baby.
Right.
Like they take your book and they polish it and perfect it so that it's better than what you could do alone.
Absolutely.
And it sounds like you have that kind of a team behind you.
Yeah. And even in the early stages of my agent and I working on the manuscript, I could tell that her edits were simply directed at making the book more of what it was rather than what she wanted it to be. And you can really feel a difference there. And it was crucial that I finished the book before I got to her, because if I didn't know what it was, which I didn't for a very long time, she couldn't have done her job. So, I mean, I'm really glad I took that route. I think it may not work for everybody, but it worked out really well for me. Knock on wood so far.
I feel like this is going to be a kind of a tough question, but I'm going to ask you it anyway. What was the hardest part of writing this book? Now, with other writers I've asked this, it's been things like, you know, oh, finding the time and all this kind of thing. But yourself, and there's another author I interviewed who are writing memoirs, I imagine the difficulty was much less the writing and more the reliving stuff.
Yeah.
Would you?
Yeah, definitely. So the finding the time was hard. I won't deny that. I actually wrote on that. I wrote my book mostly on my iPhone, on the Notes app, on the subway to and from my office. Because the New York City subway is maybe famously unpredictable. So my commute is anywhere one way from 45 minutes to an hour and a half. So, and I don't have internet, so I can't do client emails. I can't do anything. I can't be on the phone. And I was like, this is the perfect place to force me to write. And I'm a really kind of serious self-editor. I can't put anything down unless I'm sure it's perfect. But on the phone, you can't really do that. You don't have the luxury. And so each time I'm just like, as long as you're on the platform or in a train, you are writing. I don't care what it is. It could be complete mumbo jumbo. Just write it down. You'll delete it later. And every time I wrote a sentence, I was like, oh, that's not good. I'll just be like, no, I'll delete it later. I'll delete it later. I didn't end up deleting most of those sentences. That's actually how I was able to finish my book. I just had to be like, stop being a perfectionist. But the hardest part for me is not even just the social economic truths of being undocumented, being poor, being lesser. that was a little bit easier for me, I found, to wrap my mind around, because maybe as a lawyer, I could understand it from a different perspective. For me, it was seeing how the family unit was put under so much pressure and how my parents' marriage really disintegrated under those conditions, and understanding them as both who they are now and the adults they were then, and also who they were in my eyes at the time, which were very, all three things are very different. And my parents are very against me writing this book. Once you're undocumented, I think there's always the fear that you'll be deported, and they're afraid that something will happen to all of us. And I understand that. I mean, writing that New York Times op-ed about me being undocumented was the first time I publicly came out with that. And I had colleagues and classmates being like, I had no idea. And there was always kind of a shadow of doubt in my heart that was like, oh, what if they want to fire me, or whether they treat me differently now? And thankfully, I've not had any of that. It was all support. But being able to see your parents that way, you know, as fallible human beings, fallible adults, from the perspective of a child, is, I think, very difficult for anybody. And realizing what was going on and what they were going through emotionally, the conflicts and tensions that was going on that I wasn't privy to, but looking back on scenes when I was like, oh, my dad said that, and I never understood what that meant. And now I know, after the fact, that he had a, you know, tense conversation with my school's administration or whatever, and that now I understand why he did this other thing that made no sense to me and wasn't necessarily the best. That was hard. The idea that my parents would be there reading it one day was very hard. So I really had to write this book thinking that nobody would read it. That was the only way I would be able to get this done. Because then it would just be doubts about being deported and getting my parents in trouble and having a fight with my parents. The psychological elements, I think, of any of doing any task is always, I think, the hardest to overcome.
And especially when it's the psychological elements of overcoming the task, but also the fact that it's such a psychologically difficult thing to work through and process. And, you know, it's kind of like a double attack, yeah. Really. Also, congrats on being the first person I know of to write a book on the commute. That's really impressive. your parents, they're citizens now, are they? They were naturalized.
My mom is a citizen. My dad is a green card holder. And
And even with those safety nets, they're still anxious about the book.
Yes. It never, once the fear, if you've been undocumented one day in your life, just like if you've been hungry or extremely poor one day in your life, I think it's written into your body. The fear never truly goes away. I mean, even as you say, like, I went to Yale Law School, I'm a commercial litigator, I'm a citizen, even I feel it. On some days I wake up and I'm like, what am I doing? What if I ruin my entire life and everything I worked for? And that's the truth of it. It kind of lives inside you.
Yeah. That's it's an amazing story, and well done. And not only what you've achieved in your professional life, but even to like get yourself to the place that you could write about that book, it's really impressive, and it's well done. That's all I can say. And I hope that doesn't come across as condescending.
No,
to be like,
I appreciate,
oh, well done.
That. You know, I don't. We'll see. I kind of, once the book is finalized, it's out of my hands, and we'll see how the world responds to it. But there's never, as my agent has repeated to me, there's never the perfect book. It's just the book as it is in this moment, and that's what I have created. And I hope it reaches people and connects with people as much as I would.
I can't imagine it not, to be perfectly honest. It's such a crazy story. And I think the part that's the craziest is that you're just one person, and how many undocumented people have gone through the States, how many people are there still. Yeah. Like, you know, that's the part that just baffles me, you know. But I mean, to talk more about writing now, just out of curiosity, you said you make your time by writing in the notes app on your phone on the subway. So what is your process? I know you're past the real writing stage, and this is more refining and editing now. But what was your process then? So once you got to work, you commuted back home and wrote some more on the phone. At what point did you continue on from there? Like, what was the process like?
After I wrote the first draft, you mean? Or
yeah.
So, I mean, I kind of had an outline on my phone and I wrote chapters and I backed every chapter up I wrote on my phone like 5 times because I was terrified of my phone dying and me never recovering the mumbo jumbo that I just forced myself to type down. And then it became a process of copying, pasting all those chapters into a Word document and realizing how many pages I had written. Because I had no idea how many pages I wrote. I just kind of wrote and I didn't even go sequentially. So because of the psychological hardship of wrangling with some scenes and moments and memories, I jumped around in time and I was like, this is a little easier for me to write about. Why don't I write about the Babysitter's Club or whatever it is, television, learning English, and then go back to, and there were times when I felt ready to write the hard parts and I went and did that. And so pasting it into a Word document, actually sitting in front of a computer and reading things in sequence and editing and how things made sense for the reader. Because I would explain, because I wrote it in bits and pieces, I would explain like Chinese things several times through the book and I would have to make sure it was earlier on. And that really took a lot of uninterrupted time. So I got to a point in late December where I just didn't let myself do anything outside of work other than edit my book. It was all I did probably November and December. And I'm better when I'm just sitting there for 6 hours straight editing and I have to turn the internet off because there's just so many distractions out there. And not to say, like, not to even mention work emails that come in for me over the weekend, but just Twitter and Facebook and all of that. And I should say I was off social media when I was working on this book. I think I needed to be. Otherwise, I just would have spent all my time tweeting and posting photos of my dogs. And I have kind of kept that up because I do want to instill and create this habit of writing daily without kind of the self-editing and turning the internet off and just being on my computer. And as I mentioned earlier, my husband got me a typewriter for my birthday recently, and I think that will be a great way actually to force myself to write, because without the screen and the internet, it'll be a great way to kind of, and if I have a typo, I can't really delete. So it's perfect for someone who tends to self-edit, maybe overly delete things.
I saw the picture of the typewriter before and I just instantly fell in love and I was like, I'd love one. And then straight away in my head went, but if I make a mistake, I can't get back to it.
Exactly.
If I need to insert a paragraph up here, I can't. And I started panicking. Thinking I couldn't write on that, so it's lovely looking, and it would help with the self-editing, I suppose.
Yeah, it does. I mean, but it does bother me. I'm like, oh man, I'm gonna have to retype this up perfectly and not make a single mistake. Yeah, the perfectionism is a huge problem with typewriters.
yeah, very much so. What so you said you typed it on your iPhone, then you put it in a Word document. Was there any other software or tools you used that you would kind of like to pay homage to now, or was it really just those two and your agent working on it?
There is an app, I think it's called Forest.
Yes,
it blocks. Yeah, so it blocks your phone from doing anything other than the app Forest itself, and it shows you a little tree growing. And if you exit out of the app to check Instagram or your email, the tree dies. And what you want to do is grow a forest. And it's been really helpful for me because I really like those little trees and they have cherry blossoms and different trees. And I need goals. So I want a whole forest full of a certain kind of trees. So it's really helped me focus my time and not be distracted, because the inclination to press something on your phone, a text message came in, I have to see immediately what it is, right? It's always there and it's so pressing. And that really got me through a lot. And then the Word focus mode, when it's just the document in front of you with the desk behind with nothing else, that really helped me. And it was that and the sense of urgency. Honestly, ICE and Donald Trump really helped me feel like I have to get this done as soon as I could.
Mr. Tom, I'm very happy to hear that. I did try the Forest app myself 2 or 3 times, and at many stages I just had this forest that looked like it had been attacked by acid rain. It was just, everything was dead, and it just depressed me. So I uninstalled it. But if it works for some, it obviously worked for you, and if it can work for some people, you know, go for it.
There was a period of time which I had a bunch of dead trees too, you know, when I was pushing myself to write chapters that I was not ready to write. I was just like, oh, forget this, I'm gonna go see what's online now. But if you push through, you can have a beautiful, lush forest. You may have to delete the app and reinstall it again.
I might give it a go when I get down to deadlines in the future. So we've kind of covered your kind of beginnings. I didn't mention this, but if we're on episode 7 now, I'm sure my listeners will be sick of me explaining this. The way I like to do this podcast is we have the beginning, middle, and end, just like a story. So we've done your beginning, we've done your middle, you as a writer. I don't want to say end, we're going to say you're to be continued, to make it just a little bit more positive. So when we're finished here and we've said our goodbyes and hung up, what's the first thing you're going to do?
I get back to work, unfortunately. I've got about 8-9 hours of work left. So I'm running a bunch of major cases, but also I have a lot of ideas for a second book.
Great.
And I really feel the need to start working on them, and I need to commit to one idea. So I've been kind of brainstorming that and seeing what resonates with me more. And unfortunately, as I'm brainstorming each idea, more ideas come out, which I guess could be a good problem to have. So I like to spend some time at night after work thinking about that, and maybe working up even articles and essays that I have in mind, writing about mostly the immigrant experience, but I have other ideas about, you know, just social commentary as well.
Sounds really interesting. So I know you're not published yet, so you're probably very focused in on the one book, and that is totally understandable. But what are your, as a writer, what would be your kind of overarching goals? Is social commentary and the undocumented and immigrant experience something you want to really work towards, or is there other things you'd like to try, like fiction or poetry or screenplays? What's your kind of dreams as a writer?
I love literature. I love writing. I love reading. I actually mostly read fiction. So it's funny that my first book is nonfiction. There are amazing memoirs out there that have been kind of, you know, The Glass Castle and Angela's Ashes have just been real inspirations for me and real guiding points for me. But I would love to write fiction. And that's where I'm having trouble, because I do have a lot of ideas for a second book that's fiction. But with fiction, you have so many more options. You're not just tied to what happened. For me, I didn't really have an option. You know, chapter 3 was going to be what it was going to be about, because that was what happened next to me in my life and worth telling. But I think even with fiction, my dream and my goal for my writing would be to make social and political commentary, but in this way where it's humanizing and where it's about one family or one person, and you really kind of understand the politics of it after you feel connected and emotionally invested in what the story is and what the person is about. And I really see that as kind of my area in writing. And all this is to say, it's not that different from litigation, right? Like, people think of judges and as these like all-knowing technical bureaucrats or whatever you like to think of them as in black robes, but they're people at the end of the day. And what I found in my profession, my day job as it were, is that when you connect to a judge's or a juror's heart, that's when you really win the case. There's nothing more powerful than having someone just care about your client and the injustice that has been done.
It's really interesting how you're pulling like that. I think that's one of the best things anybody who writes can do, is to pull from their day job, as you said, or from their life and just use it to fuel whatever creative endeavor you're trying. Because I think you've hit the nail on the head. It's, as we said it earlier, it's about changing people's hearts first and then hoping that their minds or political allegiance or whatever will follow, you know? So I've only two questions left and then we're going to wrap up, and they're very easy and relaxed questions. So you can sit back and relax, because this has been a very tense interview on you, I'm sure, having to relive all those memories. First, where can people get in touch with you online? And when will your book be available? Do you know yet? And all that kind of thing.
Sure. You can find me on, well, I've just now discovered Twitter. As I said, I was on a social media hiatus for many years, but that's how you and I met, on Twitter. And I've discovered so many amazing people, just an amazing community on there. So my Twitter username is at Qian Julie Wang, QianJulieWang. And my website is www.QianJulieWang.com. And there you can sign up for a newsletter, a tiny letter for updates on my book. And so I can update everyone who might be interested, and also for their op-eds and essays that I may be coming out with. I'm also fairly active on LinkedIn, but I know that's more for stodgy lawyers. But if you are one, come join me on there. And my book, we are really hoping for it to come out fall 2021. That's what we're shooting for. I don't know how things will look with the pandemic and everything that's going on. So we have kind of a backstop date of spring 2022. But I will post regular updates on my social media forums and just keep everyone up to date as
brilliant. Once there's a pre-order button, I am clicking it as hard as I can. And then my final question, and I think it's the easiest question: what was the last book you read?
Oh, it's actually right here.
Oh, show us.
It's called Blue Ticket. I'm actually almost done with it, by Sophie McIntosh. It's actually a book that my editor at Doubleday edited, and it's a feminist dystopia. It's fascinating. So I don't know why I'm reading a dystopian novel now in the middle of a pandemic, but it appealed to me, so I pre-ordered it. And it's a world in which women either get a white ticket, in which case they are destined for a life with a husband and children, or they're a blue ticket, in which case they're independent, they're career women, but they won't get married and they'll never have kids. And a blue ticket woman realizes that she wants kids and ends up getting pregnant, and kind of the society, the government comes after her and she has to go on the run. And it's just a really well concocted world, and you're really identified with the main character and understanding her plight, and also makes me understand, as someone who doesn't have children yet, the joys and risks of motherhood and all that. Feels to be, you know, what you're going to gain as a woman, and also all that society portrays as a sacrifice that you'd have to kind of sign on to. So it's really beautifully written, and I really admire Sophie McIntosh for her gift of writing and her ability to come up with this completely different world. It's so different from my memoir, which is just what I know.
Who are listening right now and just thinking to themselves, that kind of sounds like today, having to choose career or family. So it's really interesting to take that to the extreme. It's something I might check out.
Yeah.
Julie, thank you so much for doing this. It has been an absolute pleasure. I messaged you a couple of hours before this saying I'm so excited, and it exceeded my expectations. So thanks so much for doing it. Thanks. Huge best of luck with the book. I'm sure it'll do amazing, because it sounds amazing already. And again, thanks for doing this.
Thank you so much for making the time. It's been a real blast to chat with you, and really great to meet you over Twitter and develop a friendship. So thank you.
I think we can all agree that Julie has a fascinating story, and I for one cannot wait to read her book. If you want to subscribe to her newsletter to get updates of when exactly the book is coming out, be sure to check out her website, which is linked in the show notes. Now, believe it or not, I know it feels like I only just started, but I'm actually starting to plan season 2 of Story of a Storyteller, which will be starting in January 2021. If you know someone that you think would be a good guest, or if you yourself would like to be a guest, head over to connorbraden.com/podcast, and there'll be a button there to say season 2, and click that to apply. Next week, I finally get an Irishman on the show. I'll be talking to Stephen Black, who is from Oma, and he is the author of Skelly Square, Bomb Girl, and his new release, A New Jerusalem. We chat about how he copes and how he lives with OCD, how a blog about his family's religion got him started into writing, and as well, we also speak about the experience he had with the terrorist attack on his hometown in 1998. It is a great interview, and it's really worth a listen. But if you can't wait for now, if you can't wait for a week, be sure to check it out on Patreon, just like Michael Andrews can. See you next time. Thanks for listening today. I hope you loved listening to this episode just as much as I loved recording it. If you like the show, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts or over on Podchaser. Until then, be good, be brave, and tell stories. See ya.